How you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Oh, I am doing excellent. I am doing excellent. I was a little late for the show today, though, because...
Because the show was early.
Right. It's odd. I didn't really plan on there being a show today, but it would be tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So when suddenly we decided to do a show, I was already late. It's like very Jake Johansson. Mm-hmm. Now I'm late for the airport suddenly.
You need
suddenly.
A green felt tip pen. That'll resolve all those issues.
No, I was watching on... I don't know if you know this, but on Netflix, I guess it's on Hulu Plus also, but I was watching the He-Man She-Ra Christmas special.
Wow. I haven't seen that in 25 years.
And it's awesome. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you what.
Is this the one where at the end, like, Skeletor teams up with Santa Claus?
This is, yeah. Well, this is, I didn't get that far. I watched most of
sorry.
It before I had to come do the show. I'll get back to it, don't you worry. But this is the one where... You know, She-Ra is busy, you know, getting the castle. Her castle, is it in Etheria? Mm-hmm. You know, ready for Christmas.
She's not on Eternia, right? She's like,
I thought
she has her own universe, doesn't she?
Right. Yeah, it's because it's separate, right? She's He-Man's brother, but they don't often hang out.
Yeah,
they
live sister,
in,
I think.
I mean, sister, yeah. He-Man is her brother, and they live in alternate universes, which makes it difficult to get together for the holidays. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, it's hard enough getting together with my sister who's up in Connecticut. But if she was in an alternate universe and rode a unicorn.
Right.
I mean, that's like if she has to bring her toddler to come to our house for the holidays and she has to get on the back of a unicorn with wings and fly from her universe to my universe, I could see how that would be a problem.
It seems problematic. Yeah, I agree.
And then they're busy decking out the castle. And I love because all of these random bit characters make an appearance in this Christmas special. So on – is her universe, is her castle, is it Eternia or Etheria?
See, if you're saying Etheria, that makes me believe that she has like her own universe because He-Man was definitely on Eternia.
Eternia. Okay, then she's in Etheria. That's like her own place.
Right.
And I think they kind of cross universes because they're wondering when Adam and Man-at-Arms are going to come visit for the holiday. Mm-hmm. You know, but he's busy doing work back on Eternia.
Right.
And so she's decking out the castle. Of course, she's getting it all ready. And I love all these little bit characters because she's standing by a big castled window thinking about, you know, just talking about Christmas and how much she loves it and how much she loves the holiday and everyone getting together. And one of her minions decides to dress up the window with some garland, but she does it with magic. She just holds up her hands and suddenly beautiful flowers and garland appear around the window. And she says, "Oh, Perfuma. That smells fantastic." And I thought, what a waste of a superpower. I mean, it almost reminds me of, you know, of...
Stinkor.
Of Stinkor and, you know, and from the New Mutants, of course, Cypher, who only, you know, could speak and understand languages. That was his only power, which to me, it's like if just that's like what Tim Ferriss does in the 4-hour work week, you know, like just, you know, just like a little bit of immersion and you're up to snuff on a lot of languages around the world. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not mutant power. So this chick, Perfuma is her name. She makes things smell nice.
Wow.
Which would be, I mean, to me, I see that as a job. Like that would be the thing that would get her hired working the bathrooms at Penn Station in New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. What are your qualifications? Like these bathrooms stink like crap. Well, I can make them smell fantastic with my magical powers. You're hired.
Yeah. I don't really know many of the She-Ra characters. You know, Hordak and the Horde originally came from She-Ra. And they were like a cool kind of like secondary wave of He-Man villains. But like her supporting players, I don't think I could name even one of them. I don't think I could even name her unicorn.
Well, even in the He-Man universe, in this particular Christmas special, you know, Skeletor is flying in this random skull aircraft that's flying after
one with the dome top,
right?
Yeah,
which you know that's aerodynamic, right? Like Skeletor, maybe he could just like lose some of the skeleton iconography. When he's building,
I don't
an aircraft.
Know that his engineering staff really appreciated that. Like probably when Skeletor met with his engineering staff and was like, "Look, I'm going to need some really sophisticated high tech vehicles here. You know, like this.
Right.
This thing is not really clear how it's propelled. You know, like those sky sleds. Like,
right.
Like, what's propelling that?
What? Yeah. What's working? And He-Man's sky sled has giant cement wheels that look like they're out of that cartoon in the Sunday comics from BC.
Mm. Are you thinking of the battle ram?
Well, no, there's one of these. Well, no, there's one that he's flying, and it has those wheels on them. He was flying through space along with She-Ra.
Oh, and he went into space with it, did he?
Yeah, and she's flying with the unicorn. The unicorn's continuing to flap its wings in space, which I don't know if the unicorn was instructed and didn't realize that there's no air in space. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you don't really need to flap your wings. And also, you probably wouldn't live in space for long if you're a unicorn.
Right, but I agree with that.
They're flying after an errant spacecraft that Man-at-Arms had built called the Eye in the Sky. That was going to spy on Skeletor to keep an eye on him. But then Orko gets inside.
I thought it was going to play Alan Parsons songs.
He gets inside. Orko gets inside the Eye in the Sky and launches it by accident. Mm. So then He-Man and She-Ra are going after it, trying to track it down. And Skeletor also is going after it. But he's flying his skeleton face aircraft.
Right. The unnamed. Because they never made a toy of it, so you never knew what it was called.
Right. It just seems, yeah, you're right about that. Like the engineering team, because he's a dictator, they have to make whatever he asks for, right? So he's I want a spacecraft that flies like and is in the shape of a skeleton's head. And they're like,
I like that accent that you did there for Skeletor.
They're like, it's part Italian.
Will you do my voicemail? I'll give you my cell phone password.
You've reached the voicemail of Mike Quackenbush. Leave a message.
I want you to follow that by doing your Bane voice.
Leave a message, good people of Gotham. That's what I'll do. My career doesn't work out in broadcasting. I'm going to do ringtones and voicemail messages.
Hey, you know, right now you can get William Shatner to do your voicemail message. Did you know that?
I heard about this. This is
$299.
Oh, that's incredible.
Mm-hmm. And that's awesome. I think it benefits Hurricane Sandy relief or something like that.
That seems appropriate.
Yeah, but Shatner's one of the main guys, one of the main celebrities. He'll do your voicemail message for you, which is kind of cool.
That's pretty awesome.
You know, years ago, I remember I was at a comic convention somewhere. And do you know the name of the guy who voices Space Ghost?
No, I don't.
Okay. Well, that guy was there when Space Ghost Coast to Coast was like a huge cult hit for Cartoon Network. And he was doing it for $100. Like, if you got in his line for $100, he would do your voicemail message, and he was making money hand over fist.
He's got such a distinct voice. That'd be pretty cool to have. I also wouldn't mind having, like, Putty from Seinfeld do it. That would be pretty cool. That reminds me, though. Well, anyway, I don't know where we're going, but
You're really concerned about what was going to happen to Skeletor and his engineering team.
Right. But it reminds me of the movie. Like, have you seen The Dictator, the Sacha Baron Cohen film?
No, but I would love to see that.
You know, it's not stellar. I mean, it's right. You know,
is it better than Bruno? Because Bruno, I was a little let down by.
No, I thought Bruno was pretty funny, but it's not as funny as Bruno. But there are some very funny moments in it. But it's a script.
Right.
Unlike Bruno, which I guess has like a loose script. It's like a series of vignettes. But Bruno is an actual movie. You know. But there's a scene where a couple of scenes. Like his guy, he's a dictator. He wants these nuclear missiles to be shaped like missiles, and he wants them to be pointy on the end. And so he goes, he's going to visit the engineering team behind the missiles, and he goes, here it is, this missile, here's our nuclear weapon. We've been working on it for 5 years. You recruited me. Here is the fruit of our labor, and it rises out of the ground, and they're standing there, and he goes, what? It's not pointy. He's like, what do you mean? So, well, I want it to be pointy, so it sticks in the ground and then people die. It's like, well, that's not quite how it works. It actually doesn't even hit the ground. And he had to completely and then he shoots the guy. I think he kills the guy off or something, or he banishes him, but he wants his missiles to be pointy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can understand that.
Like Skeletor. He just wants a spacecraft that's shaped like a skull. He doesn't care if it can fly aerodynamically or not. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah. I think since obviously that's out there, Masters of the Universe, there's a new action figure line for that. I don't know if there's a new cartoon to go with it or not. There's a new comic book series out. Clearly the license is out there. I'd like to be that guy. I want to write the comic book of, like, Skeletor's Corps of Engineers. Like, what their day is like. I'd like to write that. It'd be a one-shot. Like, it wouldn't be an ongoing series.
That would
like to write that one-shot of, like, what it's like dealing with Skeletor as your boss.
That would be a great that would be a great comedy skit too. And it reminds me a little bit of like the Star Trek books that are out there, like the Star Trek Engineering Universe or the Star Wars, and you know, there's like all those different spacecraft that someone, you know, that Lucas, I guess, film probably licensed out the rights to write those books, you know. So you've got all the different craft, you've got all the different spacecraft and everything, and you could actually write a book with that. To look at the He-Man universe, though, you'd have a unicorn, you'd have these weird sleds that shouldn't fly that have giant cement wheels on them.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a flying skeleton.
Well, there were a couple cartoons from that era, and He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, I think, came onto television in 1982 or 1983. Also of that same genre are Thundar the Barbarian and also The Visionaries, where they, even in the intro to the show, they sort of intimate the idea that technology and magic have combined.
Right.
And that there's this new, you know, whoever controls this new thing is the real master of the universe. And they each kind of had like their own take on it, you know. They had, you know, in Thundar the Barbarian, that cartoon took place on a post-apocalyptic Earth. That was the setting for Thundar the Barbarian. Whereas, you know, Eternia and Etheria and wherever the heck He-Man took place was like supposed to be in another dimension or another universe. The Visionaries, too, I believe, were on a post-apocalyptic Earth. That there had been a great cataclysm, and then in the wake of that, I think in the intro they even say where magic has become more powerful than technology.
Right.
Something like that. So, yeah, they all kind of, you know, mixed and matched that together. And the result were things like the Sky Sled, which was this little blue thing that, you know, like He-Man and all the good guys would fly around on that, you know, appeared to have no basis in reality whatsoever. Like, why that thing could fly, I have no idea. You know, there were just conventions like that. We accepted that as a child. Like, that's okay.
Yeah, and it doesn't make sense, right? They've got this giant rocket ship that's larger than one of, like, the, you know, one of, like, the, you know, large rocket ships from the 1950s that would launch satellites, you know? So it's using all this fuel that's going to take off. And Orko accidentally pulls one lever and it launches.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they can fly in these sky sleds that apparently have no emissions whatsoever.
Right. It's not really even clear how you control them. Like, they're just holding on to the sides of it.
Right, and
like,
it's just scooting
along. How
you
steering that?
It's just scooting along. What I loved about Skeletor's skeleton machine is that it's also flying through space, but they decided that out of one hole of the skeleton, it would just be having like black exhaust. So it was just had like black exhaust coming out of the ear hole.
Awesome. Wow.
So apparently Skeletor's craft is not as efficient as He-Man's sky sled. I see it. I understand.
I'm not 100% sure, but if I remember this right from my childhood, the ending of it is that Skeletor, who's like anti-Christmas, submits and actually helps Santa Claus deliver presents or something like that. That you're watching it and you're like, I can't believe I'm seeing this.
Oh, that's great. I have to get to the end of it. Yeah, I'm at
how long is it? Is it an hour?
Yeah, I think it might even be longer than that. I think it is a little over an hour. But yeah, it's on Hulu Plus. It's on Netflix also. pretty easy to find though. Right in the midst of it. And interestingly, though, because I was watching and some of the bad guys that are friends with Skeletor, they're inside his craft and they're trying to go after He-Man, of course. And they're all of these guys that I didn't recognize. Like, who was the guy? There was a guy that's like a twin, or he's got two heads, half of his body.
Oh, yeah, the blue, and he's half blue, half purple.
Yeah. He's got two heads.
Too bad.
Too bad. Yep. Then there was Merman? No,
sure.
Merman was there, of course. And who's the guy that had is it Lockjaw?
You mean Trapjaw?
Trapjaw.
Right. He had the interchangeable arm.
Yeah. So you had a whole crew like that. There was a couple of other guys I didn't recognize.
Triclops, you would have probably recognized.
Yeah, he wasn't there. He was busy doing other work.
Right. Yeah. You know, he's actually – I saw something once. Like, there was a website that had like a chart of appearances by like the other villains. Mm-hmm. And I think Triclops has the least number of appearances in the He-Man series. But he was one of my favorite figures.
Yeah.
I thought Triclops was really cool.
Is Triclops – he's the one that you spin the face?
Well,
no,
but, you know, Manny Faces Manny has the faces. Spinning face.
Yeah, yeah,
Triclops
yeah.
just has the eyes that spin.
That's
and he
right.
had like three different – he was a Cyclops.
Right.
Except, you know, you could change it so his eye was orange or his eye was blue or whatever.
And you would flick that eye.
Ones.
And you'd flick that eye and it didn't always work, right? You'd press the button for the eye and it wouldn't always, like, click over.
Well, the one I had, you just had to manually turn it. There was no...
Oh, no, no. I know what I'm thinking of. I'm thinking of He-Man's the battle armor chest plate.
Yeah.
Do you remember
this? Battle damaged He-Man and Skeletor. Right. When it would break, you know, the mechanism inside, like sometimes it would just spin continuously or, you know.
Yeah, you'd punch him in this chest and he was fine, like it would be normal. And then it would flip to him being slightly damaged. And then one more punch, he'd be really damaged and it'd be bent in toward, you know. But it didn't always work. And sometimes it would get stuck between the two states.
Right, yes. Yeah. It was the same, you know, like all of those toys, you know, they were – who made He-Man? Mattel?
Yeah.
Was Mattel the manufacturer?
Yeah.
They really were not very well made.
Was it Hasbro?
You know, like the spring inside of your Ram Man broke within a month.
Right.
You know?
Well, like I told you about all my G.I. Joes I found that my mom dropped off and they were all corpses. I mean, they were all torsos.
Right, yeah.
The rubber bands inside.
Eroded or whatever.
Deteriorated. Anyway.
I remember Mechaneck.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of my favorites. Of the latter day, but you know, as that series went on, they really did start to get into some dreadful ones, like Ninjak, like the ninja that came out of the woods, or Jitsu.
Yeah.
Like the guy who's just like, I'm Asian.
Right.
But there was one really weird one toward the end of the line that I thought was a really cool idea, but it was kind of dumb. Do you remember who Rio Blast was?
No.
His chest opened and there was a gun inside of it. Like... His body just opened and there were guns hidden inside his body. Like
that's pretty cool.
He must have been hollow inside. Like he's got a huge laser cannon in his chest.
TSA must have hated him.
Yeah.
God, you have anything hidden on you now?
I've heard some radio commercials lately because I've had to listen to terrestrial radio in the last few days that you know what's a great alternative to the hassle at the airport? Travel by train.
Hmm. I got to say, I love traveling by train.
Mm.
It's so easy. You know, you buy your ticket online. You can even go down and pay with, you know, your smartphone. You walk right up to the ticket counter. You got the smartphone, the pass from Amtrak, like right on your phone. Scan it. You don't even need to get like a paper pass out of the machine anymore. You could get right on the train, kick back. You've got plenty of space. They've got outlets so you can plug in, you know. You've got like a long train ride. You worry
about
that.
Right, you want to bring your hair dryer.
Mm-hmm.
You just plug in and
laptop.
Just go wet. Go in your towel.
Bring your bring your whole tower for your computer and a printer and a monitor. Set up a little table and get some work done. Plus, they've got a restaurant in most trains. To be fair, it's not really a restaurant. It's more like a snack shack.
Yeah.
You know, like a burger in a bag. But you can go back there. You can get a beer. You can get a soda. I mean, you can't do that on a flight unless you're flying to – what did they have those flights to Emirates now, United Arab Emirates? It's like the Emirates Airlines and it's like they've got a bar. Like a lounge. Looks like something like James Bond would take.
There definitely was something over that way, remember, where there was like a second floor, and the second floor of the plane was like a lounge.
Right. And that may be I just always see when I'm in cars and different things in the city, and they've got advertisements for things, and they show like just people kicking back at a bar, and it's like two flights daily from JFK. I'm like, oh, that's a flight I would love to be on.
Really? There's no flight I would love to be on.
Well... To be fair, I mean, if I had to take a flight, that would be one I would want to be on.
Mm-hmm.
I hate flying. As a kid, you know, you love it, right?
My son, you think it's the greatest thing ever.
But once your legs are long enough where you can't extend them and get circulation through them, that's when I stopped liking to fly.
Yeah, the novelty was gone. Mm-hmm. You know, in that last bit there, twice you used the phrase, to be fair.
To be fair.
And I've come across this a lot lately, not when I'm speaking to you, but when I speak to other people who habitually preface whatever answer they're giving you by saying this. Well, to be honest with you, and this to me would seem to indicate that I'm being lied to a lot.
Right. Because, this is the only time you're going to be honest with me? Let me get out my pad and paper. Because otherwise, better get out my polygraph for the rest of the time.
Yeah. So I've taken to saying this now because I hear this way too often. And that's like one of those things that's like a device that you have stored in your vocabulary that buys you a second to formulate what you're about to say next.
Sure.
Right?
It's like another version of
Yeah. It's meant to make you seem smarter than
Right.
Well, to be honest with you. So anytime anybody's – and I hear that all the time.
We all do it.
As soon as that comes out of their mouth, I say, I prefer when you lie.
What? And that'll probably stop them in their tracks. They probably don't realize they're saying it. We all right. say these things.
Yes.
And we don't realize we're saying them. There are all sorts of different, you know, turns of phrase that we have to buy us some time while we're thinking of the right way to say something. What do you think? I know that you have grappled with one over the past few years. Have you excised it from your vocabulary?
I don't know what you're referring to.
What was yours? You had – what was it? What was it?
You'll have to go back and listen to some old grizzes.
Oh. Man, that's going to kill me. You don't remember, or are you just putting me on?
No, I know what you're referring to, but I honestly don't remember. But for the rest of this podcast, for the remainder of the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe, and it's strange that we usually identify ourselves 21 minutes into the program, for the remainder of the time that Clayton and I are speaking, we will only be honest. We'll be honest with you about all the things that we've been up to, and we've been up to quite a bit. Certainly, we're aware that a lot of people checked us out for the first time just in the last week, thanks to an appearance on the program by Glenn Phillips of Toad the Wet Sprocket. In fact, even as of this morning, it's still being advertised on the front page of the podcast section in iTunes, and we're very thankful to our friends over at Apple for featuring us so prominently. Not long after they did that, I went outside, and there was a giant pile of cash on my doorstep.
That is incredible. It's funny you didn't mail any of it to me. You know what? Send it
to
the cashiers.
It's illegal to send cash in the mail, Clayton.
Send
cash
it to the
cashiers, and keys.
Okay. We had a lot of people who responded. Well, I'll let you continue that thought. Unless you were moving on to something else.
Right. I do want to say I feel really bad about that prank call I made to Kate Middleton's nurse. In addition to that, it's been busy. And, you know, our schedule was a little interrupted because of the fact that we had to get that one with Glenn in the can at a very specific time. So you and I haven't actually done one of these now for a much longer period of time than we usually do because of that hiccup in our scheduling.
And I've had an itching to talk to you. Maybe it's something I need to put a cream on. But I've had a lot I wanted to talk to you about, so I'm glad we
got together today. Well, thanks for listening to the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe.
Yeah, I really wanted to talk about He-Man and She-Ra, so I'm glad I got that off my chest.
Thundar the Barbarian. Thundar the Barbarian doesn't come up a lot.
I think it doesn't.
On this show, I know we've talked He-Man before, and I know we've talked about the Visionaries before, but Thundar the Barbarian rarely comes up in conversation.
And that's pretty awesome. Where are you going to get that kind of nerd talk, folks?
Let me tell you this. One of my trainees at Chikara Wrestle Factory, his abdomen is tattooed with all the Herculoids.
What?
All of the Herculoids. And it's not like just a few of the Herculoids. It's all of the Herculoids.
That's incredible.
It is, and it's an ugly tattoo. He should have gotten one of the Hanna-Barbera guys to do it.
Instead of some guy with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth with ash dripping down on it.
Yeah,
exactly. Herculoids? Oh, yeah, I've seen some crazy crap around here. I'll do whatever you want. As long as you're going to pay me $200 for it. Hey, some people wrote us and wanted to thank us for the Glenn Phillips interview.
Yeah,
Eric,
here's one from Glenn Phillips. It says, thank you.
Yeah, Glenn, thank you. And we had a great time with Glenn, of course. And you know, let me just say this. I think he was really revealing. I don't think we've had an interview like that with another artist who was as candid as Glenn was, just about the state of the business and the things that, of course, his band has had to deal with. And he didn't try to put on airs about the state of – you know, his lot in life as it relates to the music biz and the way in which Toad the Wet Sprocket sort of fizzled out there. There was no covering up of any of that or trying to gloss over any of that time period around the end of Toad, you know, during the Coil years. Mm-hmm. And he was very gracious with his time.
Yeah, very much so. I really, really enjoyed it. And, you know, in light of some of the other people we've had on the program, you know, that I would categorize myself as a massive fan of, I am perhaps less so of Toad the Wet Sprocket. But having said that, I enjoyed having Glenn on as much as anyone we've ever spoken to.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, I found another live album the day because, you know, iTunes linked to the show and then they featured a bunch of their albums on iTunes. And so I discovered a live show that Toad had done that I never knew existed. Hmm. Which is nice. So I downloaded that. A lot of great hits that they played during that show. I think it's from 1994. Yeah, it's really, really good. So check that out on iTunes. A lot of energy, crowd going wild, and really good performances on a lot of the songs that I like of Toad. Some people wrote us to thank us about that particular show. And let's see. Kenneth Blake says, Trails End Wild writes, love the interview with Glenn Phillips on the cafe. Fear is one of the best albums of all time. Eric Hoff writes, loved, not loved, loved in giant capital letters, hearing Glenn from Toad the Wet Sprocket on the show. I'm at iTunes now buying the newly re-recorded work. Thank you, Glenn. So, and a lot of other people have written as well.
Over on Twitter, Tobias Vaughn, which I'm pretty sure is a pseudonym, wrote to us. He said, hey, I'm not much of a Toad fan, but love the music business angle of the interview. Always very interesting stuff. And that, of course, is our mantra here, Tobias. Right. Very interesting stuff.
Indeed it is. So maybe we should pause here and thank one of our show sponsors, one of our long-standing show sponsors, our good friends. Over at Cobra Electronics, makers of a whole host of incredible gadgets this holiday season. If you are thinking about getting the man or woman in your life a gadget, why not make them a safer driver in the process? Get them something they can actually use every day on the road if they have to commute. I remember, Mike, you were at a show up, I don't know, in Detroit or somewhere, where you had heard from some folks up in Canada who had picked up one of the Cobra Eye radars, right? Did Mike vanish? I think he vanished.
You're not hearing me?
No, did you mute yourself by accident?
Well, maybe we had a little dropout. But anyway, yes, that's absolutely right. In fact, yeah, they ended up trekking for miles and miles and miles into the United States through the frozen, packed white tundra of Canada to come and see me with the Cobra Eye radar. And, you know, as incredible and groundbreaking as that system was, you know, Cobra's even done one better on that now. Because they've really reset the standards with their Vedetta system, which is, I would wager to say, in the same vein as, you know, when the Cobra Eye radar came out, it instantly became like the top thing. It won all kinds of awards. Like for two straight years, it won all kinds of industry awards. And I have to think that the same is going to be true of the Vedetta, because they really took all of the feedback that they've gotten about all of their other radar detector systems, and, you know, it does a whole lot more than that besides just radar detection. And they use that to build this Vedetta system so that not only is it, you know, the best performing thing out there, but it's really what the users were looking for.
We installed it in the car this week to test it out.
Oh.
Because I only played with it, you know, sort of just hands-on, you know, plugged in, but not really in a radar situation where you'd want it in the car, of course. Mm-hmm. And
you were only in a parking garage.
Right. And incredibly easy. I mean, you take it right out of the box, plug it right in to your cigarette lighter, and you can – it has a suction cup thing that will not – you know, it's one of those ones you kind of crank so it will not fall on you while you're driving. And you can position it on your windshield anywhere you want. And as soon as you plug it in, fires up, press power, done. You're all set. And some of the default settings are already there. They're turned on. So the red light cameras already turned on as a default. All of the different – radar detections that are out there. So no matter if you're traveling from state to state, because every state has a different style of radar, KU band, K band, there's like five or six different versions of radar that the police use. Those defaults are already on. You can turn on, and they have other ones you can set on your own, like speed trap. So if people have added to the database and added speed traps that they know are out there, you can turn that alert on. So it doesn't default all of them is turned on, but a few of them, the ones that they know you're going to want right out of the box. And it works perfectly. Plus, one of the benefits is, and I think the iRadar, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the iRadar does this too. When you plug it into the cigarette lighter, it'll show your battery juice, your car battery.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it'll give you how many volts you're getting and how healthy your battery is. So if you're driving, you're starting to see it slipping quite a bit, or it's not holding the charge that it did a month ago, and it's a little bit lower, a little bit lower, a little bit lower. You can see that, right? Because most of us, we're out running out to go to work or something like that. We come out and the car won't start because we just haven't been aware of it. With the Cobra Eye radar, the Cobra Vedetta system, you're aware of it, and then you won't have to worry about it. You can go get it switched out, taken care of, get a new battery ahead of time so you don't walk out to head to work and find that your car won't start.
And that does happen. That does happen to people.
Right. I think like it just happened to you recently.
Yes.
So check it out. Go to Cobra.com. Anything else you want to say about them today?
No, I think you did a fantastic job covering it. Well done.
Cobra.com. You can pick them up on Amazon as well, but they've got some great videos over on Cobra's website. Check them out. We thank them for their support. We wouldn't be able to do the show without them. And hey, it's the holidays. Can we ask all of our listeners, if you're new to the show or otherwise and you haven't done it yet or you haven't done it in a long time, go over to iTunes and give us a nice review if you would. I think, Mike, you've said before we only accept 5-star reviews. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. So if you've been thinking about leaving us something less than that, I don't know what's wrong with you.
Yeah. So just go – just take a moment. Just go over there. Just give it a little 5-star review. It helps other people discover the show because it populates to the top of what's new, what's trending, and so people can discover it that way, and it really helps us out. So thank you if you've already left one, and thank you if you're planning on leaving one.
Mm-hmm. Get on it.
So I guess we should talk – well, I don't know. There's a couple of things because I had – I was going to jump on a call with you the other day, I don't know. Did you have some medical thing? I don't know if you told me about it yet or not, but it sounded like you were getting an X-ray for some reason.
Yes, that is true. Since we last spoke, a number of things have occurred. One of them was the Chikara season finale took place. It was a live pay-per-view event called Under the Hood, and we played to a sold-out Trocadero Theater in Philadelphia, which was great, with tons of fans watching worldwide online as well. And unfortunately for me, I happened to catch a kick in a really unfortunate place, and I've ended up with a fractured rib on my right side. My 7th rib on my right side is fractured.
Mm.
And your ribs are designed to protect your lungs. That's why they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you fractured one of those, especially because of their proximity, and something were to happen to worsen the condition, you could be endangering your lung in more ways than one. So it was a little bit dodgy this weekend as I was wrestling up in Troy, New York, for Wrestling is Awesome. And it was really kind of a dodgy thing that I even got in the ring this weekend.
So you got in the ring with a broken rib.
Right. And I've wrestled injured before. I'm not new to that. But rib injuries, if you've had one, they are the worst. You can't breathe. You can't cough. You can't laugh. You can't stretch. You can't yawn. It hurts. It hurts all the time. Luckily, I happened to be in there with a guy who was a very clean technician, and we had a fine, if not overly polite, little match. But even after that, I was sore in the rib cage just from doing the little bit that I did do, and I would have felt terrible, knowing that, of course, my appearance had been advertised and I was intended to appear there if I did not appear before the paying crowd. So I did the very best that I could, but I'm looking forward to having a little bit of time off to recover from that because it just seems like this year has been I've just been one injury on top of another, and I feel myself slowing down. But and as does my Honda Accord, which is currently in the shop. Incidentally, while the Cobra Eye radar will tell you about your battery, if your starter's going, there's no warning for that on the radar.
Yeah. I'm sorry to hear about your ribs. How long do you have to wear some sort of chest plate thing or a wraparound?
I do. I have a battle damaged He-Man silver vest that I wear.
So it's on setting 2 right now.
Mm-hmm.
Slightly damaged.
It's not that one that's all scarred up. It's just kind of in the middle.
No, do you have to wear one of those kind of wraparound things that you see James Bond wearing after?
Right, they don't really do anything. You can if you want to, but it really doesn't do anything. I believe over the years I'd tried everything that you could think of for that. I'd put varnish on my chest. Yeah, nothing really helps, just time.
Shoe polish.
Rib injuries, you just need time.
Hmm. Time can't give me time. What else is going on? So we got to see – interesting. I didn't think I'd mention this to you. I got to see Jerry Seinfeld.
I heard that through the grapevine because I also do a podcast with Clayton's wife called The Trending Show.
Mm.
That you saw Jerry Seinfeld, which is crazy. It's crazy for a number of reasons because if you think about perhaps public figures that have had real influence over you and I over the years, we had an opportunity to encounter quite a few of them in a very short span of time.
It is true. Really. I mean, we of course saw the Monkees. We'll get to that in just a moment. And Jerry Seinfeld and God
here's,
knows.
Here's another weird one. Almost unsolicited, the gang over at Chikara, we were sent an interview from Jake the Snake Roberts.
Really?
That was within 2 days of us seeing the Monkees.
That's crazy. And I'm trying to think. Someone actually tweeted us about, in case we wanted to see it, that all Max Moon episodes, all Max Moon matches.
Yeah, that tweet was not entirely accurate. Max Moon has more than 6 matches, but I did go and check that out. The people at WWE.com, whoever does that website, they do a fantastic job. But So you got to go and see Jerry Seinfeld. Now, this was the one that was rescheduled because of Sandy, right?
Yes, it was on Staten Island. Of course, Staten Island got hit pretty hard, and he and Colin Quinn, of course, the opening act, and Seinfeld had to postpone it as a result of Hurricane Sandy. So my wife, as a surprise for my birthday, she said, hey, on Thursday night, guess where we're going? It's an early birthday present. And I whipped him open, and of course, it was the Seinfeld tickets. So very, very cool. And he is, you know, I don't know. I know some people have just different opinions, of course, about his stand-up and whether or not, you know, he rises to the level of a, you know, Richard Pryor or one of those kind of guys. I say this about Jerry Seinfeld. He is, I don't know that anyone practices or is more polished than he is. Mm-hmm. And it shows. He was fantastic. And you get to see that in the difference between he and Colin Quinn. Right, Colin mm-hmm. Quinn was kind of riffing on some Hurricane Sandy jokes. You know, he was.
I bet you that's just what Staten Island wanted to hear.
It was actually because he's from there. Mm-hmm. He had the cut of the jib. You know, he was making jokes about how when they would take the different news reports of the different boroughs, he'd have people out on Long Island and Rockaway who were hit. And were like, you know, we're just trying to do our best and helping people that need it. And, you know, we're going to fight through this. And he's like, then, you know, you cut to the Staten Island news crew and they're interviewing some guy on Staten Island who's going, I haven't seen one public official. I've been waiting for weeks now. You want to try to walk down that street? Go ahead. It's as dangerous. I'm not sending my kids. So he was like painting the picture of the two different, you know, the different boroughs, and the audience loved it, you know. He was making some jokes about Chris Christie. He's like every time they took a live shot of him out touring Storm Damage, he always, you know, he's walking like hunched over, and he's like, I felt more nervous for Chris Christie's health as he's out there walking around than some of the storm victims, you know. Right. Yeah, we lost our house, Governor, but God, why don't you just have a seat? You look like you're exhausted. Mm-hmm. He had some funny stuff, and he was making fun of Bruce Springsteen, and he's like, I'm sick of the boss. He's at the Meadowlands like every week. It's a big deal. You know, oh, Bruce Springsteen's coming to Meadowlands. It's a big deal. He was here last week. He lives down 280. It's 5 minutes from his house. He's like, you know, you want to do it? He's all about the working man. You want to go out there and do a concert for the working man? Don't do it on a Thursday night. Do it on a Saturday night when I have to get up, you know, at 5 a.m. to go and see a show. Where were you last night? Seeing Bruce again. So Colin was all right, but he was all over the place.
Yeah. I will say this about Colin Quinn. In hindsight, I loved him on Weekend Update. You know, he was an abrupt replacement, and I really had a hard time. I loved Dennis Miller in that role. I loved Norm Macdonald in that role. And at the time, I was like, ah, Colin Quinn. But when you go back and watch him, he does hold up. He does all right behind the desk.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's very funny and some really funny jokes, but he was just a little bit all over the place, you know. And then, you know, Seinfeld comes out, and he's just polished, polished, polished. And he did like, I think he did like 90 minutes. And he was out there for a long time, and it was very funny. I mean, there wasn't a section of his act that I thought was weak. Mm-hmm. And he did, and it was all new stuff, nothing I'd ever heard before, mm-hmm. Which was pretty remarkable. You know, when you see a comedian like that, you probably have seen clips. You've seen him on Letterman. You've seen him doing different things. I didn't hear any of this stuff before. Mm. He did a whole thing about how, congratulations, you know, he came right out and he, you know, congratulations to all of you guys for just getting out of the house and getting here. And he goes through this whole like 15 minutes about the sort of gestational period when someone makes a decision to like leave the house and, mm-hmm. you know, to go out. You probably got tickets. You probably thought this was a great idea at the time, you know, but then the night comes around and remember, we're going to go see Seinfeld tonight. What? That's tonight? What time is that? 8 o'clock. 8 o'clock? Are you serious? That's too late for me to get dinner. You know, he goes through this whole thing and just perfect. I mean, the amount of time that you know that he spends honing his craft is impressive. Mm-hmm. The timing of it, all of his jokes are spot on. You know, he doesn't take to swearing at all. It's he doesn't rely on that as a vehicle. Mm-hmm. So it was. It was great. Then, of course, you know, he has three kids now. Mm. He is – how old is he now? He's
well, you would know better
he's
than me.
50,
I don't know.
I think he said he's 54.
Hmm.
54, 56, something like that.
How has he aged?
I mean, he looks good. You know, he takes care of himself. He eats super healthy. I think he's like a yoga guy too. So he's – That's one of the things that my wife remarked about was his stage presence, mm-hmm. and the over-animated way in which he brings extra comedy to his routine by playing to sort of the back of the theater. You know, mm-hmm. when you're playing little clubs, right, everyone can see you. But when you're – it's almost very clownish, right? He has to sort of over-exaggerate the movements and things like that. But he does such a great job using his body as part of the act. There were just some great jokes. One of the things that stood out to me when we were talking about voicemail messages, there were a couple of highlights. And I'm trying to remember the exact phrasing of the joke, but you know, voicemail. He's talking about voicemail and – why do we even leave or create voice messages anymore, you know, when people call us? Mm. You know, hi, this is you know, we ask people – we record the message and we ask people to leave certain information on our voicemail messages, right? Mm. Please leave your name and your phone number and tell me why you're calling after the beep. He's like, we get the beep. He's like, I think it's been ingrained in our culture enough that we know that the beep is there. You don't need to remind people about the beep. And he talks about how, does anyone ever call? Don't we already know that we need to leave information? Does anyone ever call and just say, hey, this is a woman, call me? Of course you're going to say who it is and leave a phone number, or you're going to leave the information. Do we really, you know, and he went through all that. There were a couple of like really, really spot on stuff about having kids and, you know, the differences between man and wife and all of that stuff. And very good. I mean, just very, very well done and well rehearsed and well written. And he doesn't fly by the seat of his pants. You know that he spent quite a bit of time. And by the way, have you ever seen that movie, The Comedian, with him in it?
No, I don't think so.
It's a really good documentary. I think it won like Cannes Film Festival or Sundance or something in the documentary category. And it's all about, you know, after he left Seinfeld, mm-hmm. how he, you know, got back into stand-up, of course, because he loves it and it's his bread and butter. He then went on, you know, he would work on his material in small clubs again, you know, going in, and it shows him just bombing. You know, he's up there working on a joke and he's got handwritten notes in front of him and he's just like working on jokes and like there's no one laughing and it's just painful. But then the arc of all of that is great because he's just like working on this material and refining it and writing new stuff and refining it. And but he feels the need to like refine it and work on it in public, which is just terrifying to me. Mm-hmm. You know, like when I did that stand-up competition a few months ago, like the only thing that benefited from my failure was the mirror in my, you know, my room as mm-hmm. I'm practicing, right? And I'm just hoping it's funny enough that when I get up there, I'm not bombing, right?
Sure, but you know, that kind of material, you can only really test it out live.
Yeah, but I'm too fearful of that. So, mm-hmm. you know, he wants to test it out live. So the arc of all of that, of course, is that, you know, this massive theater the other night, and he had us laughing for 90 minutes.
And does he tour pretty regularly these days, or it's kind of like he comes out of the house for one tour a year and then he disappears for a while? And
from what I gather and from the signage that was up, it's called Seinfeld's Back on Thursday Nights, 5 shows in 5 boroughs. So mm-hmm. I think he and Colin Quinn were doing like 5 shows in the 5 boroughs. Because I overheard another woman as we were leaving saying, oh, that was great. And, you know, I saw him a few weeks ago in Brooklyn. And the person said, oh, was it, you know, like the same show? And she said, no, it was quite a bit different, quite a bit of different material in there. Very funny. I was like, wow, that's pretty good. Mm. You know, he's not just doing the same material in 5 boroughs. Mixing it up quite a bit.
Yeah. I would guess, you know, and probably ticket-wise, he must command a decent buck, you know. Like I was just reading an article actually about like Lewis Black is one of the most, you know, highest paid stand-up comedians out there, and he tours relentlessly. But, you know, Seinfeld obviously benefits from a much higher profile and the fact that the show that bears his name has been in syndication and reruns, you know, basically since even before it went off the air, you know, there were enough episodes. Usually a syndication package is, what, 100 episodes?
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, even if it were, you know, they would have had more than 100 Seinfeld episodes to start bundling for syndication before the initial, what, 9 seasons of Seinfeld, right?
Right.
Yeah. Even before that would have went off the air, they would have been in reruns.
Yeah. He was just great. I mean, and he was relatable on a number of levels, obviously, from being a parent now. I mean, none of this material, you know. It was funny because a couple of the jokes that I did at my performance, my wife leans over. She goes, "This is your bit." Mm-hmm. And it was very similar. Mm-hmm. Talked about, you know, having kids and there are only two, you know, I said my friend once said, you know, there are only two types of people in this world, those who have kids and those who don't. And he structured it the same way. He went on a different tear with it and I went a different way with it. But sort of the same structure was there. And he, you know, talked about the miserable lives of single people and the miserable lives of, you know, he just went back and forth. And he's like, and both are right. I was surprised by that. But there was a lot of great stuff in there.
Is he on Twitter, Seinfeld?
I don't know. No, he did a whole thing on social media and what a time suck it is and cell phones and, just being connected all the time, you know, with our cell phones and our devices and everything. And, you know, we talked about our coffee habits and when did we, and he was making fun of the whole Ambien, you know, commercials and all the sleep aids. He's like, I'm sure it has nothing to do with the, you know, giant vats of coffee that we're now drinking every day. Like I see a guy crossing the street carrying a giant, with his arm out straight, a giant 32-ounce iced coffee like he's won an award. Get out of my way. I'm walking across the street here. I've got a large coffee. What else did he do?
I was going to say, because Twitter's the place really to attack him for stealing your material. That's what I wanted to get at.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Something tells me he didn't see my performance. Although the place, like I said, where I performed at the Comedy Store? The Comedy Store, yeah, on the Upper East Side is where he got his start. So when I was there performing that night for that New York's Funniest Reporter competition and, you know, I was looking around. It's got old black and white photos of him up on the wall and, then, of course, they're running old footage of him from his early days there and he and Chris Rock and stuff, if that's not nerve-wracking enough. So it was great. I was surprised, though, he didn't do an encore. You know, in those situations, they usually, you know, they turned on the house lights. He walked off stage. Everyone clapped, applauded. It was great. They turned on the house lights. They were playing some music. And that was it. And I thought, oh, he's going to come back up. You know, people are going to yell out, do the socks. You know, they're going to yell out their favorite bits. Mm-hmm. Like when I saw him years ago in Philadelphia. None of that. Maybe he's just too big now. Gone. Off.
That's his thing. It's right there in his contract. No encores.
Maybe.
They can call for me all night and I'm not coming back out.
Yeah. So.
It always strikes me a little anticlimactic when, you know, the stage manager or whatever just does that. Because, you know, most acts now, whether they're musical acts, comedians or whatever, they have something kind of in their back pocket that they do as an encore and it's usually planned that way. And, you know, when they do that, when the house lights come back up and they pipe back in the music and you know the performance is over, it's like, well, what if we were still calling for another encore? That kind of is the point, right? That you're calling for people to return to the stage because you so loved their performance. But it's kind of their way of saying, like, nope, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think the encore has lost some of its luster, too.
Yes.
I think that maybe that's part of what you're saying. It's now expected that there's an
right.
encore.
Right, it's part of the set list, you
and
know.
I don't like that there is an expected encore. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like the curtain call in baseball, right? You hit a grand slam or you hit two home runs in a game and you're the one that's on fire and the crowd, every time you're getting up now, you're smacking a home run. They can't believe it. They're just losing their crap because you're just hitting home runs. Now you hit your third home run in a game and you're up like 8-0 and you're just like on fire. You go into the dugout and you hear that crowd. The crowd's chanting your name, you know, and then the other teammates push you out of the dugout again to take a curtain call. You come out and you tap your hat to the audience, right? It's because they're cheering for you to do it.
That happens to me all the time.
Yeah. I could imagine, though, right? If you've done some incredible move, you won an incredible match, you go backstage and the crowd's just going crazy. They can't believe they've just seen the match of a lifetime, and they're chanting like crazy. You know, and they're chanting for your name. Like, that's when you do a curtain call. You come back out. You walk back down the runway, and you just give a little bow to the audience. You know, that's the curtain call. But I feel like the encore has just, you know, like you said, gotten part of the set list. And now we just kind of hang out because the lights are still off.
Mm-hmm.
So we know they're coming out in a second. They've got the lights down. You know, let's just wait. Okay, here's the encore. I'm glad you guys came back for two more songs. Thank you. We expected it.
Right. It's sort of like, you know, to analogize this very directly, I think this sort of thing is also like of that same vein. If you go to see Tears for Fears in concert, and they play their whole set and they leave and they haven't played Shout,
right?
You think, you know, this is probably going to be the encore.
Something's
like
up here.
Clearly left something out of the set list that we're all expecting to hear.
Right. Or everybody wants to rule the world.
Yeah, you know, like I don't care for that sort of thing, and I agree. The encore has lost its luster,
and I'm glad that he didn't come back out. And frankly, I wonder if a lot of the audience even knows his old material. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to think his old material. I mean, those were the people who were going to see him in clubs. He got his HBO special and so forth before he ever got his television show.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do those people even know?
I think I've lost you now. Are you there?
I just had a cough like crazy.
Oh, I see. Well, why don't you do some coughing, Mr. Morris?
I will. Why don't
do
you
some
tell
coughing,
us?
And I'm going to talk a little bit about our friends over at Drobo.com. Do you know who I'm referring to? I'll tell you. I'll tell you about Drobo. You know what they want to do? They're nice guys. They just want to protect your entire digital life. Everything on your computer, they want to back it up for you. And you know something? People don't back up. What's great about the Drobo is, once you get this thing all set up, it does it in the background. You don't have to think about it. You can set it and forget it, Ron Popeil. All right? I want to tell you about something very special that's going on over at Drobo right now as the holidays draw near. They want everybody to find out that they are the easiest storage array out there. And it's true. It couldn't be simpler. If you've got somebody who works in IT or might otherwise benefit from having a Drobo in their office, our friends over at Drobo right now have a great Take a Drobo to Work contest going on. It's right on the front page of Drobo.com. It'll take you about 10 seconds to fill out the form. And then you check out one of their Drobo Live demo sessions. You do it, you'll get a $10 Amazon.com e-gift card. So will anybody that you sign up to go and watch it. And then you're entered to win a new Drobo Mini or the Drobo 5D. That is a heck of a deal. This Drobo Mini, which is one of the latest and greatest that they've come up with over at Drobo, it's portable, it's light, it's faster than anything they've ever put out before. It is the state of the art when it comes to this kind of thing. And this is a chance for you to win one of these things absolutely free.
That's awesome.
It is super awesome, Clayton. The folks over at Drobo are super awesome. I've been thinking about upgrading because, you know, the one I'm running now is a couple years old. You have an older model of Drobo, too.
Yeah, the Drobo, the old four-bay Drobo from the early days. And, you know, they listened to their customers' feedback over the years. They said it's too loud and it's a little too slow for our needs now as we've evolved. And Drobo said, ha, we went back to the drawing board, re-engineered and made them the best ever. And now if you're a videographer or a photographer or a video professional or just a – you're dealing with a lot of media like Mike is and like I am with a lot of photos, you're going to want to upgrade because now lightning fast. It's got a lightning port connector. It's got USB 3.0. It is lightning fast are some of the new Drobos. And, you know, it's interesting because I'm going to be heading on a big sort of photo trip in February.
A photo trip?
To New Zealand.
Oh, yeah?
And I'm going to be taking the Drobo Mini with me because I'm going to be shooting for 5 days, like all day. I'm going to have, I mean, I'm sure just gigabytes and gigabytes of raw photo files, which, as you know, are very large.
Mm-hmm.
And God knows I don't want them just like stored on the computer I'm going to bring with me. I need to have them backed up so that if, God forbid, something happens to a hard drive, I've got them backed up on a Drobo Mini. And that's precisely why Drobo created the Drobo Mini. Was for the traveling video professional. So I cannot wait to test it out like that in the field. It's light. It's small enough to fit in your bag. Plus, it's got all that expandable storage. You don't have to worry about one drive failing if it does. It's all backed up redundantly on the other drive. So you're thinking about upgrading for one of your desktop models, right?
Right, absolutely. Yeah, I don't have any problems with the one I run. I just know it's an older model, and I know they've got quicker ones out there that are a little more sophisticated now.
Yeah.
But, no, it's great. And, yeah, I don't know what I'd do without my Drobo. Really, really easy. I mean, once you set it up, it's like you never have to do anything again.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it works so well. It works so well. So check them out and, you know, enter that contest right now as they're looking to give one of these puppies away every week until Christmas and to the end of the year. Drobo.com. We love them a whole lot. Drobo.com.
Yeah. How'd you get roped into going to New Zealand?
It's something I wanted to do. Yeah. It's like I had an opportunity to do it. I was invited. And, you know, it's going to be like, I think 10 or 12 people as part of this, sort of photo journey. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it'll be neat to see like where a lot of like the Lord of the Rings stuff is shot, because a lot of locations we're going to are just, you know, just gorgeous. And they're out there in those spaces where Peter Jackson had shot a lot of the Lord of the Rings stuff and the Hobbit stuff. And so I've always had a fascination with going to that country. So I'll be flying into Queenstown and then from there off on the journey for a few days. So
what is your travel time? What is your in-flight travel time to New Zealand?
Well, my wife's like, oh, this looks painful for you. Mm. But we were looking at flights, and I think it's because we're going to stop in San Francisco first, and my wife and the kids are going to hang out at her, you know, at my mother-in-law's house, so she gets to spend some quality time with the family there, and then I'm going to continue on from there to New Zealand for a few days. Mm. And then back to San Francisco and then back home. Mm-hmm. Now, if I were flying from New York or the Eastern Seaboard, it's 26 hours.
Yeah.
Now, because I'm breaking it up by going first to the West Coast and then taking a few days first, breaking that up, it's only 16 hours. Mm. It's still long. But you have to go west, right? That's the easier way to go, mm-hmm. Is to go west first. So – and then back, I don't know, I guess 26 hours back. So you lose like 2 days if you're flying there straight. And then you pick up like 2 days. So it's like you're in the air and you like gain a few days. It's really weird. Yeah. Now, when you went to Japan, how long was that?
It was not quite as long as that. But it was certainly coming back the worst case of jet lag I've ever had in my life. Like yeah. I think it took me like 2 weeks to get over the jet lag from that trip. The reason that comes to mind is in the last few years, I've been offered a couple opportunities to do short tours of Australia. And they've always been on the west coast of Australia, like on the Perth side, not on the Sydney side. And that is as far west as you fly. If I went any further in that direction, they'd make you go the other way around the planet. Like it's shorter to go the other way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I was looking at the travel times of this one proposed itinerary, and my travel from here to where I was going on the western side of Australia was 31 hours.
Wow.
And then the flight home was even longer. It was like 34 hours coming home. And I just thought, I'll die. Like I can't be on a plane that long. I just can't. I'll explode. I'll detonate. I'll be the terrorist, you know. And I ended up just kind of turning them down based on that alone. Like, I can't hack that travel time. Like, it's always very flattering to be offered those kinds of things. And it's a strange place where I'm at right now in terms of my wrestling career when you're turning down more offers than you accept. But, I just looked at that travel itinerary and I was like, nope. And I'd love to. I would love to see Australia. I'd love to see New Zealand, but I don't think I could hack the travel. I don't think I could do it.
Yeah, I'll brave it first for you to see how bad it is. I thought, well, I have a lot of airline points. I'm sure you've got.
And you can use them to make the jet go faster, right?
Well, no. What I'm thinking
is – throw
the
points into the turbines.
I'm thinking that – I'm sure like you – God knows you probably have way more points than I do for the amount of travel you've done over the years. But I think I have a little saved up that I may be able to, you know, foot some of the bill or at least the main part of the flight and then maybe do an upgrade and get the get like the bed.
Yeah. That's where it's at.
If it's an extra $700 or something like that, I'll foot that bill, mm-hmm. especially if my points have paid for the majority of the flight, right? Mm-hmm. So that I can stretch.
You don't want to be the
out.
Middle seat guy on the 31-hour flight, you know?
Oh, kill myself. Yeah, that would be horrible. I can't hack it. You know, I'm 6'2", and so even that flight coming back from Hawaii or even like from San Francisco with the in-laws, like that 6-hour flight or 5-hour flight, my legs are just – yeah, I can't do red eyes either. I've tried to do a couple of those when I've had to cover different things and I've had to fly back to get back in time for work. And I'm, you know, flying overnight and I get in and it's like you don't sleep at all.
Yeah.
You know, your legs are stuck on, you know, the pillows killing your circulation. And you can't get comfortable no matter how you sit. try to crane your neck a certain way. And I inevitably, even though I know I won't fit, I flip down the tray table and I try to sleep on the tray table.
Right. Yeah, that never works.
And it doesn't work because my head's resting right against the back of the guy's chair in front of me. So it just doesn't work.
But, well, I'll be interested to hear how that goes. While you're there, of course, you know, New Zealand's really only famous for a handful of things. They gave us the Bushwhackers. They gave us the band Crowded House and the show Flight of the Conchords. That's about it.
Oh,
other than that, New
Flight
Zealand's a barren wasteland. So I think those are probably, you know, you'll bump into them. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, there's Neil Finn. Oh, there's Bushwhacker Butch. And
yeah. And Kiwis, right? Aren't mm-hmm. they called Kiwis, New Zealanders?
That's right. They do refer to themselves as Kiwis.
Yeah.
So, which is kind of charming.
Yeah.
And beats New Zealander.
Right.
As a demonym.
I like that name. I like the word demonym.
I do too.
How would you describe a monkeys fan? Just a monkeys
fan? How would
I
describe a monkeys fan?
Well, is there a demonym to describe a monkeys fan? Like,
there is. It's the exact thing I told you when we were seated there in the theater. Weak bladdered men. That is a monkeys fan.
Yeah, that's true.
As we certainly discovered, Clayton and I had an opportunity to see the three surviving members of the Monkees at the Keswick Theater in Glenside, Pennsylvania, since our last recording. This happened in the interim. And while we were probably apart from a couple children that were dragged out by their parents, you and I were probably among the youngest people in attendance.
True. Although, as my wife wondered, you know, were we the only like 30-somethings there? And no. I mean, I looked around. There were quite a few. I mean, there like some young ladies behind us, probably in their mid to late 20s. There mm-hmm. were a row to the left of us. There were a couple of young couples in there. So there were some scattered 30-somethings in there. I was surprised.
Mm-hmm.
Penn of Penn and Teller was also there.
Indeed he was, and he spoke about that on his podcast, Penn Sunday School. He talked about his experience. He saw them there, and then the very next night, he followed them the next night as well.
Up to New Brunswick, which was just up the turnpike. I mean, I drove past that on my way home. I forgot that I lived that close to New Brunswick, which is like 15 minutes from my house.
Mm-hmm.
Should have gone to see him again.
Yeah, so Penn Jillette was on the road with him. He is an incredibly knowledgeable Monkees fan, as the episode of his podcast where he discusses that and he really did, you know, let out the fact that he knows an enormous amount about that band. But he's on tour right now, is Penn, as he's released a new book called When You're an Atheist, Every Day is a Holiday, or something to that effect.
Right. I saw that at the bookstore yesterday, actually.
Yeah. So who knows? Maybe we could get him on the program to talk about that, because he's doing a ton of media in support of this book of his that is fresh out. And he even said, like, some of his management people were like, you cannot afford to take the time off to go and take in two concerts. And he was like, I don't care. I'm going to do it. Even Hank Azaria had a good time at the Monkees concert. It was sold out. Everything about it was crazy. And I think you will agree with me in that I think they really underestimated how popular this tour was going to be.
I agree.
I say that based on the size of the venues that they chose, about how ill-staffed their merchandise stand was. There was like a 40-minute wait to get T-shirts.
There was one guy who, even at the end of the night, and as we were – we'll go through the whole odyssey here in a moment. But as you and I departed ways and I was making my way over towards the front of the theater outside and kind of came around the back of – you know, we kind of went through an alleyway and I came around the front. I had gotten a T-shirt that I knew after he handed it to me and I was walking out with it was going to be too small.
You knew you got the wrong size.
Yeah. Because those concert T-shirts, you know, a medium should be like an extra small, right? I mean, that's it's like a female shirt. Yeah. So I got and it never fails. Every concert shirt I get, I wish that I had gotten a larger version because it's going to shrink.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I ended up I went back to the front door and saw this guy, and he was like a handsome guy. You know, he was like a handsome older guy with like gray hair. He probably seemed like in like a Cialis commercial. He's like one of those guys.
Yeah. Yes. That's yeah. I think that's actually what he's from.
Right. And so, and he was still as pleasant. I came in. He was literally packing the boxes up, and I said, "Can I switch this out for an extra large? I know I'm going to regret it." He said, "Let me see if I even have any left." And he found one left. And he goes, "Here you go." And he was still pleasant as could be. And I thought, this guy was staffed. He's the only one that was working, and there was like 50 people deep to try to get to that table.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked still. He was still pleasant and nice at the end of the night.
Right. Yeah. What a rare find. They're lucky they got that guy. But you know, it seems like of late, the monkeys have done a really good job of surrounding themselves with the right people. And I'm not going to claim that I know a whole lot about the guy, but I always felt like one of the men who managed the monkeys, definitely since the 80s, a guy named David Fischoff, really did not seem like a good fit for them. Well, as I just recently discovered, the monkeys are now managed by Andrew Sandoval, who you and I saw.
And met and talked to.
Yeah, he's probably the foremost historian when it comes to the monkeys. Like, he's the guy that writes the liner notes when they do the deluxe edition CDs. He spent 15 years of his life writing this book that is the day-to-day activities of the monkeys. Like, everything they did every single day for the whole period of time that, like, that monkey mania endured.
So much so that a guy next to us, standing next to Andrew, who recognized him and probably had as much knowledge about the monkeys as you do, or perhaps even Penn does, said, I need to shake the hand of the man who knows more about monkeys trivia than me, and referring to Andrew.
Yeah, and it must be a dream come true for that guy, because to eyeball him, I'm guessing he must be roughly our age.
Right.
Like, he doesn't look like a guy that's in his 20s. He doesn't look like he's pushing 50. Like, he must be roughly our age. It's tough to tell. He has like a puckish quality to him.
Right.
But this is the guy who is like the world's most devout monkeys fan, and now he's their manager.
He's Tim Freeman from the UK version of The Office, who plays Bilbo Baggins in the Hobbit movie. I mean, if I had to pick his doppelganger, I would say that's who that is. Is it Tim Freeman?
Yeah.
Tim Freeman. He looks exactly like that guy.
Yeah. And you could see he was walking around. He was a proud peacock.
Right.
When it was all going down, Andrew Sandoval, he kind of wanted people to see him. And then I found out afterwards that at least as of now, I don't know if this just happened since Davey passed away, that he's running the ship. And he is the one that convinced, back when they first started the discussions about them coming on the road, you know, all four of them until Davey passed away back in February, he's the one that convinced Nesmith to go back out on the road.
And he said, as I talked to him, you know, the one guy said, how long did it take you to write the book? And he said, 15 years. Mm-hmm. Then he said, and it took me about a year and a half to put this together.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, as we were kind of talking while we were standing around, one of the things that I feel is true is just like the changing circumstances of Nesmith's life is what's probably prodded him out onto the stage again. You know, certainly I think being confronted with the mortality of themselves, you know, in the wake of Davy's passing. I think the fact that whatever it was now about 2 years ago that Nesmith's wife, his third wife, filed for divorce from him. I think he's in his failing health. I think this is an opportunity for him to get back together with his old friends. As he often said in interviews, the monkeys are like the brothers I never had. And to go out and to feel a little bit appreciated again, and certainly that was the case. There were tons of reviews written about these concerts. Every major newspaper and every market that they went to covered it. It was covered by bloggers. It was covered by everyone. And this is our own review of it right here. Without a shadow of a doubt, he was the star of the show.
Yeah.
When they announced Peter, there was the ovation you expected. And when they announced Mickey, there was the ovation that you expected. And then they introduced Michael Nesmith, and the roof was blown off the place.
And throughout a number of songs that were played, you'd hear the audience as the song was wrapping up and the song was over. And in the intermission between each song, you'd hear people yell, "We love you, Mike." I never heard a "We love you, Peter."
Right.
I think I might have heard a "We love you, Mickey." But mostly it was all Mike.
Yeah. And it really heavily featured his stuff, which was great. You know, I was worried that he'd be content to be like a background player because Mickey's the showman of those three.
Right.
But they played tons of Nez tunes. They played Papa Jean's Blues. They did a swampy version of Sweet Young Thing, which I think was a real pleasant surprise. They played all of his songs off of Headquarters. In fact, they lumped them together. They did them back to back to back. You Told Me, Sunny Girlfriend, You Just May Be the One. A song that he wrote that was sung originally by Mickey, The Girl I Knew Somewhere, Mike sung it, which I think caught the audience off guard. And not to be outdone, a Peter Tork song, For Pete's Sake, which is also typically sung by Mickey, Peter sung. There seemed to be a really even division between the three monkeys. You know, Peter's usually the one that's minimized, but I think he got more than ample time to shine.
He got to play Auntie Griselda.
Mm-hmm.
What else did he play? There were some other.
Both of his songs from the Head soundtrack. He did a long title, Do I Have to Do This All Over Again?
Right.
And Can You Dig It is his other song from that.
They played You Told Me. They played She. Mm-hmm. What else did For Pete's Sake?
Right. They did tons of stuff. They closed with What Am I Doing Hanging Round, which I thought was like a great choice to close with. And not that I it was strange to me that every time I've either seen the Monkees or seen a live recording of them, they encore with the exact same stuff. It's always Listen to the Band and Pleasant Valley Sunday. And that's exactly what they did here as well. So I don't know if that to them has almost become a tradition over the years. Like even when they did the 80s reunion tour, that was how they did their encore. It seems like such an odd thing, right? That you would do the exact same two songs as your encore all the time. But that's what they did. And I really think they tore the house down. They gave the audience exactly what they wanted to see, exactly what you wanted to hear. There was nothing off of Just Us. There was nothing off of Pool It. There was nothing off of Changes. Like, the albums that are not really, like, the classic Monkees canon, you know, they either weren't featured in the TV show or weren't featured in the movie Head, were not part of this.
Right, like A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You. Did they play that?
A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You is from the TV show. But,
I don't know. What's the song I'm thinking of off of from the 80s?
That Was Then, This Is Now?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, That Was Then, This Is Now. They didn't play that.
No. And I really thought that they would play it. If you'd asked me, I would have bet, because that's Mickey and Peter together.
Yeah.
I figured they're absolutely going to do That Was Then, This Is Now. And I figured they'd do Heart and Soul, which was the hit off of Pool It. But
I have a couple of observations.
Please.
Because I'm not as steeped in the more recent work of the Monkees and the relationship and the stuff that they did. Certainly you have more experience having seen them on tour, or at least Mickey, Davey, and Peter on tour. I did not. So I was there not only just to enjoy the music, to see Mike Nesmith, but from like a sociological standpoint, I really wanted to experience this concert from that way, you know?
Sure,
I was there to hear the music, but it's not like going to a Pink Floyd concert, The Wall, where you're just, you know, you're going to soak it all in. Like, I just wanted to see the dynamic of them on stage.
Yes.
You know, so from a sociological standpoint, to me, it was very fascinating, because I noticed it seemed like Mickey was more than effusive towards Mike.
Mm-hmm.
He went out of his way a number of times during the show to praise the songwriting skills of Mike Nesmith.
Mm-hmm.
And here's another great song written by Mike Nesmith. I mean, he went out of his way a couple of times to point that out. Am I wrong about that?
No, I think you're exactly right. I think they wanted him to feel as comfortable and like beloved as they could possibly make it, because for the reasons we discussed in the months leading up to this, I think the number one concern of everyone, and probably Andrew Sandoval, their manager too, is that Mike will pull out.
Right. So I thought that he was being praised enough, and you know, the crowd obviously was giving him standing ovations, and they were and even in the bit where they were having this sort of comedy back and forth about him getting the Moog synthesizer, and it was a very funny sort of back and forth that, you know, they probably had scripted with he and Mickey. And Mickey was saying that he had the lyrics to the song, because he didn't even know the lyrics, so he had to make sure he got them, and he had them, you know, embossed in 16 karat gold.
Right.
Now, Mike, you said you were going to get this Moog synthesizer. That's the reason you wanted to do the song. Where is it? And he said, "Well, I had a little bit of problem getting it, Mickey. It's very expensive, and they don't really exist anymore, and it would take up the size of this stage, so I don't really have one, but I've got a backup plan. I've got a photo of it. You know, they put it up on the screen, so there was this giant picture, and it was almost like Ken Burns style effect. You know, it was like zooming in on this photo of this Moog synthesizer, and it was very funny. He got to be a bit of a character by voicing some of the Moog synthesizer sounds Mike did while he was playing. It was very funny. To me, it looked like, you know, If it were normal circumstances and they didn't have this history, that would have been one of those things where Mickey might have been like, all right, let's tamp this down a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't need to go so overboard. But, you know, it seemed like they were putting the ball on the tee quite a bit for Mike to hit.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way it struck me.
Yes. I think so. I think they probably justly had some concern that he would get a negative reaction from a part of the Monkees fan base. He's the one that he typically is, he does not participate in the reunions, generally speaking. Obviously, there's a number of people out there that were embittered by the fact that when they were back on tour again in 1997, he did the UK leg of the tour, and then despite having been promoted for the US leg of the tour, pulled off with no warning. I think Andrew Sandoval and the other people that are now managing him, some of whom we actually ended up interacting with quite a few of them as the tour was over and they kind of identified everybody that made it happen. I was looking at their little photos and I'm like, wow, you and I talked to like all those people that night.
Yeah.
They must have been hyper aware of the fact that there are people that think that he was waiting for Davey to die before he came back, which I don't think is the case at all. There are people that feel like he's messed up the previous reunions. You know what I mean? He's the one that never plays ball. And there must have been a fear that there'd be a negative reaction to him, which just isn't the case. And it's not the and it's for this reason. You think about the audience that was around us, and the reason that people went to see this particular tour is you've waited forever for them to do this.
Right.
In the U.S., Michael Nesmith has not played a full tour with the Monkees since the 1960s.
Wow.
And the people that came out to support this are the ones that wanted to see him. If you didn't want to see him, you definitely did not pay the crazy ticket prices to go and see this. You stayed at home. And I think there are people that are aware of the fact that he doesn't really enjoy playing live. He's not a consummate live performer by any stretch of the imagination. Like, more times than not, like, he's fumbling on stage, right?
Well, that
like,
was one of my other...
How many times did we see him looking at his iPad with a confused look on his face while the other guitarists covered for him?
That was one of my other observations, which is, you know, they seemed like they were tight in parts. It seemed to me as if as the show unfolded, they became more comfortable.
Yeah.
And they kind of got back into their groove again. And yes, I know they were, you know, they spent a month or so rehearsing ahead of time, but you never can account for live audience. And being up there when you're playing so loud, you've got the things in your ears and you're having a hard, you know. So that whole dynamic, if you haven't done it for a long time, you know, it's very hard to replicate when you're just in a rehearsal mode. And so, you know, I just thought right off the top, yeah, there were a couple of times when it looked like he was slipping up a little bit or they were just a little off. I heard some errant bad notes at some points.
Right.
But I think as the night went on, it certainly but, you know, maybe this is why it was so smart of them to do these small performances like that. You know, if they had attempted to sort of sell out these massive auditoriums, they might not have, and it may have come across as less personal, and it may have just may have faltered. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I think they did well. They had an 8-piece band that backed them up, and that was a smart move.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were very few times when the Monkees themselves were actually like the lead players. Mike did play lead guitar on Pleasant Valley Sunday. He was rhythm the whole rest of the night.
Right.
Peter played lead bass on You Just May Be the One, and the bass piece is really key to that song. He played banjo on a lot of the songs, too. The ones, the more country-flavored songs, Peter played banjo on. And there were a few times Mickey played drums, but only a handful.
Right, and he came out. You know, what did he play with the big drum, the big kettle?
Randy Scow's git.
Yeah.
And even that, you know, they didn't quite exactly get that right. Mickey played percussion on Sweet Young Thing and, you know, they started off wrong. And you saw them look at each other and laugh. Like, and there were a few times like that. You know, Peter wasn't ready to start the one time. And Mike said, I'm waiting. I'm waiting. You know, they had this kind of playful thing. And it was fun to see them interacting with each other. The last night of the tour, they closed the tour at the Beacon in New York City. And one of the things that all the reviews pointed out was that during the performance at some point, Nesmith gave the finger to Peter.
Really?
And but people said, you know, it seemed really playful and Peter laughed it off. But they were like, you know, everyone was saying, this is what we've been dreading the whole time that this tour has been promoted, right? Is that it's going to break down. They're going to start fighting again.
Right.
Somebody's going to walk off stage, you know, or whatever. And that. But they did. They managed to get through it. It was only 12 stops. You know, it was a Thursday through Sunday gig. Then they'd be off Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. They would start again on Thursday. So they had time off. They weren't always together. It was clear they were not traveling together, as Clayton and I came to discover as the night went on. They seemed to be doing a good job giving each other some space. And literally, even the way the stage was set up, it was as if Mickey was between Peter and Mike.
Right.
Like, he was stationed as, like, I am clearly the peacekeeper here. But it worked. And it was great. And everyone around us had a great time. Everyone sang every word of every song. It was this great communal outpouring. And this, I thought, of all the weird things you and I observed that night, from Mike's very strange choice in shoes to whatever, every weird thing, like, is that Penn Jillette sitting right behind us?
Right.
There were – next to us, there were two women who I would guess they were in their 60s. Does that seem fair?
Yeah.
the two ladies that were next to us.
Yeah,
two ladies in their 60s were next to us. And in front of us, there were a couple guys. One guy was like in a white sweatshirt wearing loafers with no socks, who was very loud and opinionated about everything. He wanted to be heard as often as possible. And then there were a couple older guys sitting next to him, and I don't think they were all together. As the lights were coming up and everyone was leaving, as you realize, listen to the band and Pleasant Valley Sunday was all the more you were going to get, they started to talk. And the two ladies realized that they had been at the same Monkees concert in 1969 as the two guys in front of us.
Wow.
And they were like, I still have the ticket from that show. And the guy was like, I still have my ticket from that show. And can you believe that they played Salesman? Because they never play Salesman. And the lady's like, I don't even remember them playing that. And that weird sense of community that, like, the Monkees draw out of people, because they do cross generations. They were hot in the 60s. They lived on throughout the 70s and reruns. They got hot again in the 80s. There's more than one generation of fan that loves them. It just brings out this enormous community of Monkees fans. There were, like I said, there were little kids that were there singing every word of every song, and there were probably people, you know, up into their 70s that were at this concert enjoying it every bit as much as we did. And as I'd remarked to you, it was just it was a real life experience.
Yeah,
to have been part of that, you know, to see them up there together, for the most part, getting along, paying tribute to Davey, paying tribute to the TV show, the legacy of the movie Head, and of course to their music, which is really what I think is at the core of everything. Did they play everything perfectly? No, they didn't. Did they sing everything just the way it sounded on the albums? No, they sure didn't. But it really was the Monkees concert I think any Monkees fan would want to see. And I don't mean that as a slight to Davy Jones, who was, you know, for obvious reasons, fairly underrepresented. They did show the music video from the one episode of the TV show of him singing I Want to Be Free. And they used the clip from Head where he sang Daddy's song, which I was convinced Mike would sing because originally that was meant to be his song.
Yeah, they had these little intermissions where they would all
the bathroom breaks.
Right. They would all go off stage and they'd play like this musical interlude. I'm going to cough again here. But yeah, I thought that was interesting because they had, you know, they said they had these signs up outside that said no intermission during this show. So if you got to go pee, you got to go during some of the musical performances or you got to do something else, you know, there's not going to be an intermission at all, which during a concert, there's not usually an intermission unless it's the wall. But for the band, there certainly was an intermission. There was like two of them built in.
Oh, there was more than two.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there was like three actually, because they got to play. They did all these like musical interludes with Davy Jones on screen, and I thought it was an odd choice. Although I think it was smart that on the screen, I don't think we mentioned this, above the drum sets was this big screen that was showing the entire concert footage from the 60s. Show.
Right. Yeah, they showed tons of clips from the television show, including like the musical romps that correlated to the songs. You know, like while they were playing Papa Jean's Blues live, they were showing clips that used to accompany Papa Jean's Blues on the TV show, which was great. Like it was a beautiful multimedia presentation. And then they would get to something that was about Davey and everyone would leave the stage, like as if they were leaving the stage to him.
Right.
But we came to realize, like, these are like the bathroom breaks for them.
Right, sure.
Like, that's what they're doing. There were some points where, like, only one of them would be on stage.
Yeah.
For the Porpoise song, only Mickey came out on stage. Like, yeah. Everyone else was gone, like, having another bathroom break while we're all the men of weak bladders are, you know, sitting there like, oh, why didn't I go? But this theater, this undersized theater, like, when we got there, there was a 20-minute line to get into the men's room.
Right.
So It was an interesting choice in all around. Everything about this tour was very, very fascinating to me. The way it came together, the way it was organized, the buildings they chose, all the choices that they made. And I was very touched by all of it. Even the bit where they brought a fan up on stage to sing Daydream Believer in Davey's place, which could have come off very hammy, I think.
Yeah, and the guy, a little pudgy guy. With a tucked-in blue shirt, obviously wasn't the greatest singer in the world, but it didn't matter because it's one of those like Sweet Caroline-style songs, as written by Neil Diamond, of course, that you can sing along with and not have the greatest voice in the world and it's still passable, right?
Right.
Everyone was singing along with him, though.
Sure.
And so it really added to that sense of camaraderie, and it really was. For me, it was, you know, it was a real magical night. You know, it just was was just special top to bottom. And so, you know, I was running around taking some photos. I brought a good camera. I didn't bring like the longest lens that I should have. So the stuff that I got, I could only reach a certain point. Like I wanted to get closer and get up, you know, some of these great concert photography shots. And I got a few that I really like, and I'll share them with you later on. But so I was moving around a little bit and went down in the aisle to try to get as close as I could, and went around to the other side to get some close up shots of Mike. And you know, it was great to see him smile a couple of times.
Right. Yeah. He really, you know, he almost has like this practiced frown.
Right.
And the few times that he really, you know, that he did, he smiled, genuinely seemed to be enjoying himself. Those were like some of the best moments of the concert, because you do get the sense that at times like, you know, I don't know that he really wants to be up there. But then something funny would happen and he would laugh or whatever. And
also
the crowd laughed with him.
Yeah, to be sure. And you know that he had a great rapport with the audience. Mm-hmm. He had a great way, and he, just the timing of some of his jokes, the way in which he interacted with the audience, they got it, you know, and it didn't seem disjointed. And so one of the surprises for me was also seeing Mike Nesmith's son was up on stage as well playing.
Yes.
Playing guitar.
Both Mickey's sister Coco and Nez's son, Christian, were part of the onstage band, and Nez's daughter was one of the backstage hands.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When the tour was all over, someone took a photo of everyone responsible for the tour with the Monkees, and they're identified in the picture who they are. And that's how I knew. As I was looking at him, I'm like, well, that's the guy that we talked to here, and this is this guy that we talked to there. And like, oh, that's what Nesmith's daughter looks like. And so, yeah, it was really interesting all around.
So the tour's already over, huh? I thought they were doing like a West Coast bend. No?
Well, they started on the West Coast. They started with their California dates. They ended in New York. And now they're kind of like two sets of rumors that are swirling around. None of this seems to be coming from official sources. One is that they're going to replicate this in Europe. They're going to take it over there and maybe do something similar, like 2 weeks worth of shows over there. And the other thing that they're talking about is like they're going to do more of like a full-blown tour next year, the three of them.
Hmm.
But again, as we talked about in the months leading up to this, as this has been a constant topic of conversation on this podcast, Nesmith had said that in the spring of 2013, he's going out touring doing his solo stuff. And this would seem to conflict with it, unless it's, you know, if they're talking about doing a full-blown major U.S. tour, that would seem to conflict with the fact that Nez himself was planning to tour. But having heard what his solo gigs were in the U.K., which were these bizarre kind of almost depressing shows, versus this, I would so much rather go see him in this setting again.
Right.
Than go, and I love his solo catalog of stuff. You know, we bumped into a loyal member of the Egghead Army while we were there, Kevin, who came up and introduced himself to us, as if we were most certainly not the most noteworthy celebrities at this particular concert. But you know, he remarked to me, he said, I've always been intimidated by Nesmith's solo catalog. Like, where do you even start? And one of the reviews I read, which I think was in the Philadelphia Inquirer, said that, you know, Nesmith typically abstains from these because he's busy with his, like, esoteric, inaccessible solo work. And to people like that, I think you just need to sit down and listen to And the Hits Just Keep on Coming.
Right, just start
from
there.
1972.
And that's exactly what I did when I got home, actually. Or on the drive home, I was listening to a little bit of Monkey stuff. But then, you know what? As the night was wearing on, it was like 2 a.m. as I was driving home.
Yeah.
And I put on And the Hits Just Keep on Coming.
Right. That is the perfect entree into the world of his solo catalog. And it's his most stellar work. And I would love to go out and see, like, the idea that he's playing half of The Prison live. Like, I would love to go and see that. But having heard that, you know, what that sounded like on that UK tour of his, I thought, I'll leave that so disappointed and depressed. And the Monkees concert, on the other hand, was like euphoric.
Right.
The optimism that show really embodied came out in this concert. And we didn't want to leave, nor did we for several hours.
Right. So I know we're getting a little long in the tooth here, but so that's the end of the show. That's the end of the audio performance of the Monkees show. But then some of the fun for you and me started after they left the stage. And So that's where we'll enter this territory now. So now, at this point, you and I had not yet gone to the merchandising table to try to grab a T-shirt because the line was just too long. And we thought,
right,
you know, actually during the show, there was no one at the table. And I could have gone up and bought us shirts so we didn't have to worry about it. But I was busy trying to snap some photos and such. So having said that, we waited. The end of the show rolls around. We thought, okay, people are milling about having this conversation about having seen the monkeys in the 60s. We can't really get out of these seats. And I said, let's just try to see if we can get backstage. Let's see if there's a way to go. And as we're standing there and trying to make our way out of the theater, Penn Jillette is walking down with like one of his handlers towards the backstage area. So he's presumably going in to say goodbye, say hello, whatever, great show, that sort of thing. Maybe go out to dinner with them, who knows. We never saw him again. When he entered the backstage, he didn't come out like some of the other folks did. We got down to the front of the stage and we pretty soon realized that there were a bunch of other people with some special passes, some backstage passes that were all sort of sitting in the front, like in the front two rows, that were sort of waiting to get a chance to meet them. Like they had been preordained, right?
Right. They'd either won some kind of radio contest or they were on some kind of special mailing list where you could buy a backstage pass or something like that. And, you know, there were a couple fans there. We saw one girl who was wheelchair bound and another girl who was autistic that was awaiting the opportunity to go backstage. And it was very clear that at least one, if not all of them, were basically like right behind this door where we were.
Right. You could hear their voices.
Yes.
So then Andrew comes out, who's the guy that put the concert together, of course, and who'd written the book. We were standing there. He kept like looking around. Either he just wanted to like inflate his chest a little bit and walk around.
Yes, I think that's exactly what that was.
Or he was looking for someone. And to me, it seemed like he was just wanting to, like you said, peacock a bit. But hey, right. Whatever. You know, to each his own. You know, and bravo for him, right? Good for him. Good on you for putting together a great show. So good. That's your stage. That's your bow, you know? And so we were kind of waiting there and we had talked to a manager and a security guy about saying, hey, would it be possible for us to get a chance to say hi? So we'll see what we can do. We'll see if they're even here. Let's see, you know, with these other people who have been waiting, we'll wait. So we waited and we waited. And one of the managers finally came out and we had a conversation with him. We said, you know, I said, my buddy here is a huge Nesmith fan. I am as well. Would it be possible to go back and just shake hands and say hello? And he said, you know, he's already left. You know, he's 70 years old and doesn't really hang around. So he's already gone. My apologies. And I said, well, what about Mickey? He said, nah. And he said, and I thought he was lying to us.
Yes, I think so.
He said, no, he's already gone. He's off to a bar. With some friends. I said, oh, okay. And I thought he was just, you know, putting us on. Saying, just trying to be nice, but basically saying, scram, guys, get out of here. You know, and then the only person left and the only person meeting these fans was Peter. And I think for you and me, we just didn't care.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to push to go see Peter.
Right. And as Penn Jillette reveals in his podcast, at least Peter and Mike were hanging out backstage for quite a while. Like he goes into great detail about the conversations that they were having backstage after he got back there. And I mean, we were right on his heels, you know. Penn Jillette went backstage, and then we went right down to that door where we saw him go.
Yeah.
But I did get the sense from reading, and some people were very smart to do this. They follow Nesmith's son on Facebook and had remarked that most nights what happens is Mike walks off the stage, towels off, changes clothes, and walks right out, gets in a car that's waiting for him, and disappears. So, you know, by the time you could even get out of the theater and get around to the back entrance where you know they're coming out of, he's already gone. You know, he's gone within 5 minutes. But it seemed, based on what Penn Jillette was saying, that they were actually kind of like lurking around backstage for a while and everything else. So that seemed like a dead end.
But I think by the time that guy came out and talked to us, that was a half hour. There's no way that he was still there at that point, right? I feel like at that point, Mike's gone. Had we had the opportunity to go back there, we would have only found Peter, I think. But so so we think he's lying at this point. So we make our way out of here to go, and you know, we get out of there and we go and we go up to the merchandising table and we manage to get some T-shirts. They're still there. We take off. Then we went around back and I think we attempted to see if the tour bus was pulling up. We didn't know where it was coming and who was going to get on it and who was already on it. And I don't know that we figured that out, right? Or it was only Mike supposed to be on it, or Mickey and Peter, sorry. Mike had gone.
Right. Yeah, it seemed like Mickey and Peter were traveling the bus and Mike was gone. And, you know, after Peter finished up his obligations, where obviously he had some meet and greets with fans that were arranged, they hustled him into the bus. And that same guy who'd blocked us inside, I saw him, like, carrying Peter's bags out and that kind of thing. And, you know, obviously there were a couple fans that were waiting out there as well. And Peter was, I think, more than happy to be recognized by people at his age and with his limited talents. So, you know, he took the time to meet the people and then was kind of hustled on board the bus. And then you kind of heard I heard them saying, you know, that they're just waiting on Mickey. And in the meanwhile, you had kind of found him.
Right. So I go out to get my T-shirt exchanged, and we had said our goodbyes. I thought, you know, you were going to go to your car, and I was making my way to my car. And there was a tavern on the corner, and it looked like a fun place. And I really didn't feel like just getting in the car and driving back yet. And so I glanced across the street, and I thought, oh, who's that guy? That's Mickey Dolenz standing inside the tavern that I was talking to you about possibly going and grabbing dinner at earlier in the night. Hmm. And it looked like a fun sort of sports bar tavern, you know, in Keswick. You know, Keswick Tavern, as it was called. It seemed like the hub of the neighborhood.
Right.
Certainly was the hub of where everyone came out and wants to watch a game on a Monday night or a Thursday night football. That's where you go. You don't go anywhere else in that town. So I walked in, and I made my way back to this sort of private room area. And I didn't realize it was a private room. There was no security guard or anything. I grabbed a beer and walked mosey my way back. And I'm kind of standing there right next to Mickey Dolenz. I'm standing right next to him. He's talking to some people. He's got a hat. I didn't want to interrupt, but I'm like a foot from him. Mm-hmm. And then I just made my way back out to see if you had gotten my text and you were on your way over yet. And I thought, cool, we're going to be able to hang out in this room and talk with him, you know. And I go back out and I kind of mill about looking for you, and I kind of walk back over, and I'm kind of in between the two rooms when an older woman waitress just says to me, "Can I help you?" And I said, "No, I'm fine." She says, "Well, this is a private party." I said, "Oh, then I guess you can help me. I'll stand over here." Mm-hmm. And then you had made your way over at this point to try to get in to see if we could talk to Mickey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it just seemed like it wasn't going to happen. Yeah. And the night was getting long, and the night was getting cold. And
it was cold. Yeah,
it just seemed like it was just going to go on and on, like all night. There was no – every time we thought it was about to wrap up, we're like, he's coming out now. No, he wasn't.
Yeah. And then he sat down. We're like, oh. And the tour bus told you, the tour bus operator told you, well, one of the people still hauling stuff onto the tour bus. Oh, we're only waiting for Mickey now. They already had torn down the whole set. Everything was ready to go. They were ready to leave. And he said, no, we're just waiting for Mickey. And then I look over at the bar, and he sits down like in a chair at a table with a whole bunch of people. And the people taking photos. And it seemed like they had won like a private party thing. Because
right,
it was all
agreed.
The people in those first few rows that had special passes were kind of hanging out in some capacity. They seemed like they were executives, sons, or you know what I mean? It was like that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, so. It was – I don't know. I don't know how we were not on that mailing list, but we weren't. It was really strange too as I observed their crew like loading up their stuff because, you know, we were kind of poking around. We're like, hey, you guys staying in town tonight or you're taking off? And they're like, no, we're leaving for Jersey tonight because we want to be you know, up early for the New Brunswick show. Like everyone on their crew had like a Cannibal Corpse shirt on or like Sepultura, you know, like death metal, like a Jared Jarsacrack band
right.
type shirt on. And I was like, how did you guys end up doing this for the Monkees? Like that seems like a really strange fit there, guy who likes Cannibal Corpse.
So then we parted ways, and I guess Mike had long since gone and traveled probably with his son in some capacity or was off on his own. I don't know, but yeah, you got to see the dynamic after the show of them splitting up and going their separate ways. And so anyway, I've got the phone numbers of some interesting people as it relates to the Monkees. So we're gonna work to try to get we're gonna try to get some of these people on the show, whether it's Mickey or maybe even Andrew. And God knows we'd love to get Mike on the show. So who knows?
It was quite the adventure. It was quite the life experience. And
Adams.
You know,
Kevin
just
Adams.
Seeing them up there, you know, and, you know, it was on plain display. You know, some of them have – none of them have really aged well. Mickey just hides it better than the other two. None of them have really aged well. Like, it's sad to think, like, you know, if they really do decide this is the end of it, then that probably was the last time that the Monkees will ever play together.
Agreed. Personal highlights. Kevin Adams writes us on Twitter as he was there that night, and we had a chance to meet him. Very nice. And I was – my apologies to Kevin. I had – I didn't hear his name, and I was focused on trying to work the security guard. So if if I seemed cold, Mike, I know you were talking with him. My apologies, Kevin. When he walked away, and Mike said that was Kevin Adams, I said, oh, and I felt bad about it. So my apologies, Kevin. But he said his personal highlights from the show: "Going Down" song. Mm-hmm. Papa Jean's Blues and Pleasant Valley Sunday, yours. And I'll just say, I was excited to hear Sunny Girlfriend.
Yes.
That was one that stood out to me. And you just may be the one, you know. But some highlights for me were just hearing that whole string of Nez songs back to back to back off of Headquarters.
Yeah, that was really cool. And I really liked hearing What Am I Doing Hanging Round. You know, I know some of the songs that that Mike did sing over the years, they weren't ones of his. And What Am I Doing Hanging Round is not a Michael Nesmith song, even though it was sung by him. It was a cover by a friend of his, Michael Martin Murphy, who's probably best known for his 70s one-hit wonder, Wildfire. So, you know, they kind of did this opening bit of the show and then said, these were all done for us by famous songwriters. And now we're going to sing the songs that are by us. And they transitioned into the Headquarters era stuff. And right. I got the feeling like you were not going to hear them doing any more covers. So What Am I Doing Hanging Around was like a really pleasant surprise and a great way to end the show. And I was delighted to hear it. Even though there were a lot of Nez tunes, like I would have loved to have heard The Door Into Summer or things like that. I thought they rocked it on Circle Sky, which was like awesome to hear. I really like that. I love that swampy, sweet young thing that they did.
Yeah.
And did you get this sense too? I'll tell you this. I'm not a fan of this song. It's such a weird song. But they did Early Morning Blues and Greens off of Headquarters, and Peter sung it.
Oh,
I loved it.
Yeah.
Like, it was such a weird choice. But especially early on, I felt like they were doing the fastest versions of the songs they possibly could.
Right.
You know? Like, they didn't bring the chorus back around one extra time for you to sing along. Like, if this song was 2 minutes long on the album, it was 2 minutes long live, and we're going right to the next song. Like, in the beginning, they were just pounding them out. Like, it was boom, 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 song after song after song. Like, with there was no chatter between them. Like, you know, I think
right.
Like, just get to the first pee break. If we can get to that first pee break we've arranged for ourselves, we'll be okay.
Yeah, I really felt like the highlight for me was that Headquarters part. When they finally got to that section, they slowed it down a little bit. They had more interaction. And, you know, as they made mention, you said the other songs were written for us. These are the ones we wanted to do. They also elaborated a little bit on that, which was, you know, we were told to do certain things a certain way for a long time. And this is the period in our career where we decided to say, no, we're going to start to do some things our way. And that's this period of the music, and that's when they went into it. So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, I like that. They did tell a little bit of their story and how that came together. And it was roughly in chronological order, too. You know, up until they got kind of to the very end there when Daydream Believer came around. Like, they played them roughly in chronological order. Like, this is from the first album. This is from the second album. You know, this is from the middle period here and there. And Headquarters and Head were the two most heavily represented. And it really was. They just did a great job mixing it together. Just great choices. I love the way they did Daily Nightly with Mike playing the part of the Moog. I love that they did Tapioca Tundra. Like, I was thrilled with the way it went.
Yeah, me too. So there you go. That was a little rundown of our Monkees encounter. We'll have to see what's next for us, what next show we're going to go see. I'm trying to think what's next on the docket. Maybe we can try to see. We'll see what Nesmith does on his solo stuff, if he ends up doing that or not. But
yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah.
But well, we really ran long here, and I know Clayton's about to be sucked up into a vacuum cleaner, so we're going to sign off for now. But in between the next Grizz and this moment right here, you can catch me over on Daddy on Board. That tends to publish toward the end of the week. I'm also on The Trending Show, but don't worry, when I'm not, sometimes Clayton is. That publishes over the weekend. Clayton's also on Fox and Friends. You can catch him live on the Fox News Network doing tons of live television every single weekend, and even on occasion when they let him during the week. And then we'll return with the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe for you in about 7 days, eggheads.
Yeah, we will. Till then, have a great mid-December. We'll see you.
Goodbye now.
Latter December.